You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Andy Borowitz, in for Leonard Lopate, and this is WNYC and WNYC.org. Michael Connell's new book, The Limit, tells the story of the Grand Prix Championship of 1961, when the first American-born driver, Phil Hill, won. It describes the post-World War II years leading up to that event, when a battered Europe reasserted national identities and conflicts in a sport that was defined by daring feats, intense rivalries, and an unbearable amount of carnage. The book is published by 12, and I'm so happy it brings Michael Connell here today. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
So now, when we think about racing in America, we think about NASCAR, and that's a very different story from Formula One in Europe. Does Formula One occupy a different space in the culture in Europe than NASCAR? Because NASCAR, although a very big sport, I think of as being not our major national sport. I think there are other sports. We'd think of NFL football or NBA and baseball being bigger. I don't know, hockey might be a toss-up. But what about in Europe? Where is Formula One in the – I mean, I know soccer, you know, European football is huge. But where is Formula One in that cosmology?
Well, Phil Hill, the main character of this book, was a kid who grew up in Santa Monica in the 1930s and 40s. And he was a hot rodder. Mm-hmm. And he drove what was then called midget cars, and they drove.
What's a midget car? Love that term.
A midget car is a cross between NASCAR and a demolition derby. They're little tiny cars that would go around, often a dirt track, around and around and around and around. And that's what car racing was then in America, and it's largely what car racing is now. You go around counterclockwise with your wheel perpetually turned to the left. And Phil Hill, he saw beyond that. He, for some reason, was able to see beyond the culture of American racing and look to Europe, where, as he put it, cars could exist in their natural habitat, by which he meant the countryside, the hills, and the steep turns of the great race courses in Europe.
And the Grand Prix, what is the route that the cars take? What does that look like?
Well, it takes lots of different forms. In Monte Carlo, they raced in the streets, and they would be whizzing by storefronts and they would go, you know, 130, 140, 150 miles an hour.
How does that even work? That seems so surreal to me that they could do that.
They did. That was a course, and is a course, where they don't reach, you know, the highest speeds, because it's a serpentine course. They have twists and turns, and so they never have a long straightaway, which allowed them to get up a whole lot of speed. But it was like all of those courses. I mean, it was dangerous in its own way. It was not unheard of for drivers to fly off the course and land in Monte Carlo Harbor, and then the scuba divers would go down after them.
And what's the pedestrian casualty count like in those? I mean, they can't possibly emerge unscathed.
They would pretty much clear the streets. for that one. But having said that, in those days there was a real spectator fatality, because these cars, you know, it was fairly common for these cars in this era, when there were very few considerations for safety, to fly up into the grandstands. And there was, you know, at Le Mans in 1955, more than 80 spectators died.
80 spectators.
Yeah, 80 more than 80 spectators died. And just to give you an idea of what the sensibility was like then, they didn't stop the race.
Well, yeah, so they were – now, first of all, how exactly did that gruesome accident happen? How did that occur?
Well, it happened this way. Mercedes was not in racing for many years after World War II. I mean, the German car manufacturers were digging themselves out of the rubble.
Right.
And when they came back with tremendous force, with enormously powerful cars and beautifully engineered cars. And At that race in 1955, a Mercedes, the driver simply lost control of a Mercedes in a kind of dicey maneuver right in front of the pits, and the car flew up into the – first it hit a stanchion, and then the car parts sprayed across the grandstand like shrapnel.
And the race went on.
And the race went on, which tells you a lot about the sensibility in those days. They really had – I mean, a race, sort of to answer your earlier question, racing was the big sport in Europe in those days, and there was almost no consideration for safety at all.
Well, there were a couple of elements to it that seemed directly related to the war. I mean, there was this intense nationalism, right? Wasn't that a part of it?
The nationalism was very, very raw and close to the surface, partially because World War II was still a recent memory. And
sure.
In working on this book, I often felt like the ancient grudges of Europe were very much at play on the racetrack. And these were the years before television coverage, and consequently, they were the years before sponsorship. And so there wasn't... They didn't have media handlers. You know, it was all very kind of crude and raw.
Mm-hmm. Do you think the fact that Europe had just been through this immense conflagration where there were so many millions of people killed, did that harden the spectators for the kind of brutality that they were going to witness, or did that play any role at all, or were there still just agendas that were being played out somehow in these races?
That's a very good question, and in some ways that's the question that lies at the heart of this book. I feel as if in some way the Europeans were in love with the idea of sending these handsome young men out in this sophisticated machinery, throwing themselves at one another, and when they died, and make no mistake, they almost all died in this period, they would hold these beautiful funerals through the streets of Milan or some other city. Mm-hmm. The pageantry.
Like gladiators.
Yeah. The pageantry of the death was somehow deeply meaningful to the Europeans.
Mm-hmm.
Not meaningful at all to Phil Hill, the American driver,
right.
who was anguished and terrified the entire time and was not afraid to say that.
Well, now, before we get to Phil Hill and how he became a part of this world, after that big accident you're talking about, Mercedes pulled out of the race, right?
Right. I mean, there was almost the sense when Mercedes came back in and their car flew up into the stands. This was at Le Mans in France.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could almost imagine people saying, oh, my God, they're back. You know, they were back, and they, you know, they brought the death with them. And in the middle of the night, Le Mans is a 24-hour race. In the middle of the night, the word came from Mercedes headquarters in Stuttgart, pull the drivers out. They dropped out of that race, and they didn't race again for many, many, many years.
I'm Andy Borowitz in for Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm talking to Michael Connell, whose new book from 12 is The Limit, and it's the story of the Grand Prix Championship of 1961, and the American-born driver, Phil Hill. So Phil Hill is driving these midget cars, and he's a real American California boy. What is his entree into this? I think of Formula One as being like full of all these James Bond kind of characters. They're very suave and kind of, I see them slipping out of their cars into tuxedos and all that. Is that an unfair stereotype, or is that kind of somewhat close to the mark?
No, the European drivers were from the British and the European royalty. They were from the richest families.
So not in NASCAR, Europe. Not they NASCAR.
Were, they were bon vivants and unbelievable playboys. And you know, Phil Hill was a hot rodder from Santa Monica. So when he started to race in Europe, it was a complete paradigm shift for him. He was used to being treated like a surfer or a rodeo rider, and he went to Europe, and you know, they were literally at cocktail parties being thrown by the most glamorous women in Europe.
Oh, I love this one of his rivals, this German guy, Wolfgang von Trips. And was he a count? What was his
Wolfgang von Trips was Phil Hill's friend, teammate, and great rival.
Mm-hmm.
They had a rivalry that was similar to, say, Muhammad Ali and Frazier in Europe.
They had a little
ecosystem
that was necessary.
They had a rivalry that kind of gripped the entire continent. And they were friends, but they were opposites in every imaginable way. Phil Hill drove with his brain. He was a very cerebral character and very attuned to the mechanics of the car. Wolfgang von Trips drove entirely with his nerves. He was not interested in the nuances of the car. He simply wanted to go fast and win. And he wanted to win because he badly wanted to be the hero of a demoralized, divided Germany.
Sure. Now, they were different in so many ways. Phil Hill was more ascetic in a way. He wasn't a womanizer, a bon vivant like these other guys. Where did that come from? It seems like he was such an alien figure, not just in his American-ness, but in all these character ways. Why did he define himself this way? What went into that?
Well, it would not be going too far to say that Phil Hill was an artist. He had an artist's sensibility, and he was a talented musician, and he grew up in a household filled with music, and His feeling for music and his feeling for cars were very, very close together. And so what he really cared about was the car. I mean, before the races, he would chain smoke. He would wring his hands. He was neurotic and anguished about the danger. But the moment he got into the car, he was at peace, and he was really, it's a cliche to say it, but he was really one with the car. I mean, he played the car as if the car was a great instrument, a piano or a Stradivarius.
You call him a sympathizer. What does that mean?
That was a term that people at that time used in regard to drivers. Did he have sympathy for the car? I mean, you have to remember that this was an era when the drivers themselves did a lot of the engineering. It was very – they didn't have – of course, they had mechanics and engineers, but the drivers would be the cars were, of course, relatively primitive compared to what's driven today. Drivers would be very involved in developing the cars. And Phil Hill's great genius was that he understood the cars in a way that the other drivers didn't. And it was not uncommon for him to drop back in a race, to slow down and come in a few places behind other people simply because he thought that's what the car required.
So he was being kind of diagnostic as he was driving.
Right.
Did that have to do with his being a mechanic? Because he had an understanding of the cars that these suave playboys who just slipped into the cars didn't quite have.
Yeah, and he was interested in mechanics before he was interested in being a driver, and that's because his parents were terrible alcoholics, really abusive alcoholics, and cars were a way, and mechanics were a way for him to escape to a predictable, ordered world.
Mm-hmm. And so he was working for Ferrari. Is that who he was?
Mm-hmm.
Was
yeah.
Tell me a little bit about Ferrari. What kind of a guy he was? He seems like a very, very colorful European character as these.
Yeah, Mr. Ferrari, Enzo Ferrari, arguably created one of the greatest brands in history, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we still talk about and revere Ferraris all these decades later. But he was a very kind of a dark genius, almost like a villain in a James Bond movie. I mean, he was a very dark Machiavellian character. He was not a mechanic or an engineer. He had been a mediocre driver. But his great genius was that he could identify people's weaknesses and exploit those weaknesses. And he would drive these people that worked for him constantly out of their comfort zone. And he would pit the drivers against one another. He created a kind of culture of sibling rivalry, partially by hiring more drivers than there were cars to drive. So they had to compete with one another.
So this sort of Darwinian weeding out process he was creating.
Right. So to drive for Ferrari at that time was a great blessing because the cars were the fastest cars. But it was also a curse because those Ferrari drivers, you know, they died one after another.
And Von Trips actually wasn't he injured a couple of times in
he was injured over and over mm-hmm. again.
So seriously,
many,
right?
Seriously injured, and he was injured so many times that his colleagues started to call him Wolfgang von Crash. And many of those drivers, Mr. Ferrari used to say that when a driver got married, they couldn't drive anymore because they would slow down. And also, if they were injured, they couldn't drive anymore because they would slow down. Von Trips, to his credit, you know, he came back from his injuries faster than ever. And he gradually began to understand what Phil Hill knew all along, which is that sometimes to win, you have to slow down.
So tell me how the 61 Grand Prix played out and how Phil, I mean, you don't have to spoil the story for us, but tell about what Phil had going for him that made him the first American-born winner.
Well, by 1961, Ferrari had gone through a very tough period when the British were winning because of some ingenious engineering. But by 1961, Ferrari came back with an almost unbeatable car called the Sharknose. And so it was a foregone conclusion that a Ferrari driver would win the 1961 championship.
What was different about the car? What was the engineering innovation at that point?
Well, Mr. Ferrari dismissed the British as garagistas, he called them, as they were really kind of guys who were tinkering in their garages, mm-hmm. in his mind. But the British, discovered that they could move the engines around and the cars would be much faster, and it was also a question of the balancing of the cars. So when you see a picture of the Sharknose, it looks like speed in the 1960s. It captures, I think, a certain moment. It's the jet age look. The question was Phil Hill or Wolfgang von Trips going to win that year? Most teams would have designated a lead driver and asked the other one to step back. Ferrari knew that he could get the most out of them by pitting them against each other. And it was, without exaggeration, almost a death sentence because they knew that the championship would be decided by one of them crashing and dying, and that's what happened.
Mm-hmm. Was this the fact that he was an American who did this? Did this make it a huge story in Europe? Because Phil Hill is not a name that I know of. I'm a big sports fan. I'm not a huge Formula One fan, I must confess. But this was the first time I really heard of him.
I think he's the greatest American champion that Americans have never heard of.
Until now.
And when he won the championship and he came back to America, he was on that TV show To Tell the Truth.
Oh, show? Yes, and no one knew he was.
The show is predicated on the fact that nobody knew who he was.
Right.
So it was a very bittersweet period for him. He had won the championship. He came back to America and he was not celebrated in the slightest.
Well, I think you've evened the score a little bit with this book, hopefully. I've been speaking with Michael Cannell about his book, The Limit, Life and Death on the 1961 Grand Prix Circuit. It's published by 12. Michael, thanks so much for joining us today. Good
luck. That's been great. Thank you, Andy.